On this episode of Baseball Barbacast, we dig into the Cleveland Guardians in first place and just beat the New York Yankees. We also preview the Women's College World Series Championship Series, all that and more on this episode of Baseball Barbacast. Hello and welcome to Baseball Barbacast, the only baseball podcast in the world losing more helmets than Jose Ramirez. I'm Jordan Schusterman. Jake Mintz remains on vacation, but what a treat it is to be joined by my special guest co-host. It is Zach Meisel of The Athletic. Zach, welcome to Baseball Barbacast.
How exactly are you losing helmets? I don't follow.
You know, I'm trying to think of the last time I wore a baseball helmet. And honestly, I'm going to throw this back at you. When's the last time you wore a baseball helmet? Zach, as someone who covers the Cleveland Guardians for The Athletic, you have several bits that you have become known for, I would say, and we can review some of those. But one of them that I am referring to there in at the top is you keep track of every time Jose Ramirez loses his helmet on the bases, in the batter's box, or I guess any other situations, if you follow him around on off days, if he's wearing helmets and then losing them. But yeah, when's the last time you wore a baseball helmet? I'm trying to come up with the answer for me.
I have a four-year-old who is in his first year of T-ball, as you know, and I had to try on his baseball helmet. He wanted me to wear it. So, sorry to ruin your bit here, but the answer is like within the last 2 weeks.
I assume, like Jose Ramirez's helmet, it also did not fit. But how did that work for you? Was it probably pretty painful to put on a small child's helmet?
Yeah, I was a little nervous that I wasn't going to be able to get it off. But the Jose thing dates back. I think I've been doing it now for a decade. I think 2016 or 2017 was the first year. And there are other players who lose their helmets because they're running amok on the bases, right? Or they slide and it just gets jarred loose. This guy, it happens everything he does. We've seen him lose his helmet just because he swung too hard. We've seen him lose his helmet diving back into first on a pickoff attempt. There have been times where I think he's just knocked it off himself because let's just get it out of the way. I don't want this to happen, you know, as I'm sliding into a base and it might affect the play. So the crazy part is this has been going on for 10 years or so, and he hasn't changed helmet size. You would think you would just get a smaller helmet, find one that fits better, but he hasn't done that. And we might be on pace for a career best here. He's already at 45, and we're not even at the midpoint of the season. So, yeah, I think the career high is for the regular season is 96.
Oh, so he's on pace doing to top great. That.
Yeah.
Yeah, and we know that offensively he hasn't really been quite at his level. Had a big game last night against the Yankees, but the base running is right. I mean, he's stealing bases like crazy. And this is also timely to be talking about helmet. You mentioned, is he going to make an adjustment? We just had an injury on Monday. I don't know if you saw this. Chandler Simpson had like a legitimately concerning injury where he stole second and his helmet bounced off and hit him in the face. Has Jose ever suffered anything like this through all the years? Has there ever been a close call like this to your recollection?
No. You know, there was one years ago in Houston where he was running to second. And the helmet flew off, and in his foot, like, kicked it. You know, when he's running and his foot's behind him, kicked it back up in the air, and then it hit him in his head as he was sliding into second. Like, the physics there should be impossible. But no helmet-related injuries.
So, Zach, you are here today to talk about these Cleveland Guardians. And before we get to the present day, again, as you just made very clear, you've covered this team for quite some time. You do cover the rest of the league as well for The Athletic. But you're also the co-host of the Selby is Godcast, a podcast with your pal TJ Zuppi, which I certainly enjoy for those Guardians fans. If you've not checked this podcast out, highly recommended. But I wanted to take the opportunity to throw this back at you because I have spent the last 10 years explaining to people what Cespedes Family Barbecue is. They're like, what's the deal with the name? And so for those who have maybe seen this in your bio or have seen the title and maybe listened to the podcast and have no idea, I just wanted to give you a platform to give a little quick background behind the name of the title, Selby is Godcast, before we start talking about the 2026 Guards.
Yeah, you know, my co-host and I, TJ, we joke sometimes, and I don't even know if it's joking, but we're like, man, any regret that we kind of hitched our wagon to this player that, you know, the diehards and the people who are old enough to remember this moment from 2002, they get the bit, but, you know, there are a lot of people who don't, and you're right, you have to explain it, and it's maybe not worth the squeeze there. At least you can shorten it to Barbacast. If we shorten ours to just the Godcast, it's kind of arrogant. So, but there was a player named Bill Selby. He was a utility infielder, and it was 2002, and it was a summer of transition for Cleveland because they had this great run in the 90s, and ending in 2001, where they were selling out every single game at Jacobs Field, and they were winning the AL Central every year, and then having some heartbreak in October, whether it was the World Series or a different round. And in 2002, they were starting a rebuild, whether they wanted to or not. They had traded Bartolo Colon for three prospects that no one knew anything about, but they turned out to be Grady Sizemore, Brandon Phillips, and Cliff Lee. Pretty good trade. But by July, they'd fired their manager, and they were just, it was the first year of just kind of disarray, and they were playing the Yankees at home. It's July 14th. Mariano Rivera's pitching. The Yankees had a 7-0 lead at one point. Cleveland cuts it to 7-6. It's the bottom of the ninth. Bill Selby's at the plate with the bases loaded. And it is David versus Goliath here, right? And the best part is that he lined one down the line and it landed just foul. But it would have been a walk-off double. And Tom Hamilton, Hall of Fame radio voice for the Guardians for the last 36 years, shrieked. He thought it was a walk-off, and then he apologized because he got too excited and they ruled it foul. And he'll tell the story. He always says, like, when you have a play like that, it always ends in like a strikeout or something, you know, inconsequential. It's the player never then delivers again after getting so close. Sure enough, Bill Selby hits a walk-off grand slam to right field. And it is just like the moment was improbable, right? So he became like a mini cult hero for a couple of weeks. And fans started bringing signs to games that said, Selby is God. And so, like, you have to really, really know your history and some of these crazy random moments to know it. But it's funny, there've been, like, I don't know if it's engagement farming or what, but there, I feel like I've seen so many posts on social media recently saying, oh, it's the bottom of the ninth, Mariano Rivera's on the mound, what one hitter are you picking to go to the plate? And they want you to say Barry Bonds or Mike Trout or whoever. And I can't tell you how often we have people send us these posts and say Bill Selby. And I'm sure whoever created the post has never heard of Bill Selby. But lo and behold, he became the namesake of a podcast. We had him on once in the infancy of the podcast. I think he thought it was cool at the time. And I have no idea if he knows that it still exists. And hopefully he doesn't mind. But yeah, Bill Selby.
That is awesome. I knew like 20% of that. So thank you for filling the gaps in. That was very informative and hopefully entertaining even for those people who did not grow up in Northeast Ohio. But we are going to still continue to talk about the Guardians because they beat the big bad New York Yankees last night, and that is our opener. Now, Zach, as you know, I have been bothering you in the Progressive Field press box for the last couple of years since I moved to the area. As he just made very clear, Zach's much more familiar with the history of this franchise. But now that this is also the team that I am closest to, it is one that I have watched. These last few years have been very eventful. They have won a lot of games. They have lost a lot of games at certain times that made you think this team stinks. They have, of course, won consecutive division titles. And now to start 2026, the Cleveland Guardians are once again in pretty good shape. And some of that has to do with how bad the rest of the division is and how bad the rest of the American League is. But this week we have this series in New York that you are there covering at Yankee Stadium between the Guardians and Yankees, who have been two of the best teams in the American League so far this season. We will have a rematch next week in Cleveland, which I will be in attendance for. So I'm looking forward to seeing them in person for these teams kind of on the same field. But for those who haven't been following this Guardians season so far this year, catch us up to speed. Like, why are they in first place? We know we've talked a lot about the Tigers' disaster, the Royals' disappointment. The White Sox are there, but they just lost a couple games to the Twins. What is working for the 2026 Guardians, and what's maybe different that people need to know compared to the last few seasons when they've been good?
Yeah. Jordan, you're an advanced metrics guy, right? Like, you'd like to dive into the numbers. Yeah. So there's a new metric.
Usually.
I don't know if you're familiar with this new metric, though. It's called X-Dog, and it is what the Guardians bullpen has used to evaluate some of their teammates. Yeah, that's. I don't know if it's on
FanGraphs. Okay, yeah. I'm lifting up my FanGraphs mug. I don't know if it's on there yet, but I'll check with Meg Rowley about that.
Yeah, I think they're it's still in beta testing, but they're it's basically. Look, Parker Messick is the perfect example of this. He might not have the flashiest stuff, but he's got a 2.21 ERA, and he got called up last August and pitched really well down the stretch last season too. So we might be at the point where we can say it's not a fluke. This is a team that has three rookies thriving. And yeah, there's a little bit of the Guardians that people are accustomed to where they don't hit for a ton of power and it's just slapping the ball over the place and running and pitching well, like that still holds true. But I think there's a little bit more legitimacy to this team because of the rookies. And they say Messick rates well in X-Dog because this kid is supposed to be a rookie who's, you know, terrified of a big moment, like a lot of young players would be naturally. And yet he is just fearless. And it's the same for Travis Pezzana, who has come up and looked like a polished veteran drawing walks. And, you know, they pulled Stephen Kwan out of the leadoff spot because he wasn't performing well. And Stephen Vogt kept saying, you know, I prefer Pezzana hitting sixth or seventh. And it took a week. And then Pezzana was in the leadoff spot. And I don't know that he's ever giving that up because he just looks like a perfect fit there, hitting right in front of Jose Ramirez, who's hitting right behind Jose Ramirez. Another rookie, Chase DeLauder, who debuted in a playoff elimination game last season. So that tells you his X-Dog must be off the charts, right? It's a team that has young players who don't look like they're young or inexperienced or daunted by anything. Perfect example, playing in Yankee Stadium for the first time last night. You know, Travis Pezzana steps up to the plate, bases loaded. They need insurance runs late. The two guys in front of him struck out. They had the bases loaded with nobody out. And Pezzana, you know, gets his veterans off the hook and laces a three-run double to right field. So I think that's been the key. You know, they're not hoping and praying that Nolan Jones figures it out or that Bo Naylor figures it out. They've got young, and it's not like scrappy underdogs. Pezzana was the first overall pick. Chase DeLauder was a top prospect. So the talent is, you know, it's showcasing itself. And I think this is a team that they've got a lot of work to do still and a lot of development. But it's a team that I think is definitely more legitimate than it has been the last few years.
Yeah. And I think people are so used to be assuming that the pitching is elite. And there are some components of that are still in place, right? The fact that Emmanuel Clase is not playing baseball right now. And yet
you don't know that.
Oh, that's true. The fact that Emmanuel Clase is not pitching the ninth inning for the Cleveland Guardians right now, and they had a Cade Smith, who it's not like he came out of nowhere because he was doing it when Clase was there too, but for him to just seamlessly be able to transition to just be one of the best closers in baseball is not that surprising because we watched him as a rookie, and yet what a luxury, right? And that's a credit to Cade Smith. It's a credit to the Guardians and everything. But that's an incredible thing to have. We started to see some cracks with the pitching a little bit more recently, both in the rotation and the bullpen. And there are some concerns there, especially on the health side. Eric Sobrowski, an unbelievable start to the season. He gets injured. Seems like he'll be back reasonably soon. But just going back to last night, I mean, it's not just that they go into Yankee Stadium and are undaunted. They, you know, give Cam Schlittler his worst start of the year. Cam Schlittler has been arguably the best pitcher in the American League this season, and I don't believe he had allowed more than three runs in any start until last night. Velocity was a little bit down, but still throwing harder than most starting pitchers, and they were able to knock him out before he could finish five innings. So that was really impressive, general approach. I know Bezzana talked about that last night. But yeah, I mean, this is why Bezzana is special, and this is why I was so high on him, why I, even in that loaded draft, I was like, look, I just trust this guy's floor more than anybody else. And there are a lot of other hitters in that draft that you could say the same thing about, whether it's Weatherholt and Kurtz, but who cares about that right now? The fact that Bezzana is, and this is also why you bet on someone like him, because of the makeup, maybe his numbers in the minors last year, more so this year, they kind of popped, weren't like, oh my God, it's going to, but for, oftentimes the best players are putting up their best numbers in the big leagues. Like, they're going to get better and find ways to succeed at the highest level. I think Travis is a great example of that. So yeah. Now what happens with Stephen Kwan? As you mentioned, Kwan's still someone that we're trying to figure out what the expectations are with him moving forward. Jose Ramirez has not had the kind of MVP level offensive impact so far. Although last night, three doubles, which, ready for this statistic? I don't know if you, maybe you stat headed this last night. How much digging did you do on his three double game? Did that raise any eyebrows?
Well, I know he's got five, and the most recent was August of 2024.
And what stood out to me is that five is, there's not a lot of guys ever. I think he's only like the 23rd player ever with five three-double games, which, again, is about as niche of a stat as you're going to get. But hey, that's Jose Ramirez, and any kind of sign of offensive impact, which he has relatively lacked by his standards so far, is exciting because of what you have these younger players doing. And frankly, DeLauder has certainly cooled off. I know he's had some bad luck with some batted balls, but he's weird because he had, what was it, four homers in the first three games, and then has how many home runs since? Three? Two? Like, yeah. Home runs have not really been as part of his game since that first week, but he's still getting on base and clearly putting together as good at bats as anybody else on the team. So what's put the Guardians in this good position is that they've been consistent. They have avoided any sort of skid. With that win last night, they ensure that for another series, they do not get swept. They're one of only three teams in baseball that have not been swept this season, along with the Dodgers and the Braves. And so I do think that there's a lot to believe in here. However, I think them playing the Yankees is also a reason to kind of zoom out and talk about what it's like to cover a team in a small market that is thriving and that you have seen win a bunch of games in the regular season. And you have, of course, famously seen get oh so close to winning a World Series 10 years ago, but since then have repeatedly watched them come up short in October, oftentimes against teams like New York, where the talent on the other side, of course, the payroll, but this really the star power and the overwhelming amount of physical ability on the other side is stark. We certainly saw that 2 years ago in the ALCS. And now we have these two regular season series, and maybe the Guardians will sweep all of them and we'll be like, okay, great, they can keep up with them in October. But as you've covered this team over the years, how do you kind of almost compartmentalize the realities of the Guardians, for better or for worse, and where they're kind of getting to? Is there still a sense, well, hey, if they get in, anything can happen? Or is there almost a feeling of like, man, like, how are they ever going to beat a team like the Yankees or some of the other heavyweights that we've had in the playoffs over the years?
It's funny that you frame it like that, because a few weeks ago, it was early, the Guardians, they were kind of right around 500 for the first month of the season. And then they had a little stretch and they sort of broke away from that. And at that time, I remember someone asking me what I thought of the team this year. And my initial retort was, oh, you know, I actually think they're pretty good. Like, it feels like they could lose to the Yankees in the ALCS, which we've seen a ton. But really, this stretches back. This is not new to this decade. This has been like this since the dawn of time. I mean, first of all, this franchise hasn't won a World Series since 1948. And it feels like every time they get to the postseason, they're facing the Yankees. And it's got that David versus Goliath feel most years. And now they've beaten the Yankees sometimes. Someone was asking me, I was talking to Sandy Alomar actually yesterday about 1997, when he conquered Mariano Rivera in game four of the ALDS, and Cleveland won in five games. Do you know the Guardians have a veteran player on the roster named Rhys Hoskins? I don't know if you're familiar with him.
tell me about his background. He seems like a nice fellow.
Yeah, nice fellow. He hits home runs sometimes. He likes being praised afterwards. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. Yep. He's been a National League guy his whole life. And he was asking me about sort of the history. He's like, there's history and a little maybe bad blood between these teams, right? I was like, yeah, you know, pointed out there was the incident a few years ago with Miles Straw kind of climbing up into the stands to admonish some fans who were yelling stuff at Stephen Kwan. There was the infamous bug game in 2007. The one year that Cleveland was the favorite and looked like they were a juggernaut destined to win a World Series, 2017, they were up 2-0 division series, and they just collapsed, and the Yankees won that series and advanced. There have been just a lot of epic wars like that over the years. And you're right. Like, it does. It's just two different worlds. it really is. Because of the payrolls, because of the market, because of the fan bases, but it also because these teams always seem to meet up, right? So mm-hmm. it's different. Like I, you know, covering the Cleveland side of this, I vividly remember one winter meetings talking to Eric Boland, longtime Yankees writer with Cleveland roots, and he understands the dynamic as well as anyone. And I remember just saying, you know, I come here and I'm just passing the time until we get past the Rule 5 draft and I can fly home. And you come here with like a list of 60 different players the Yankees could sign or trade for. And you've got to talk to 30 different agents. And I was like, I can go take an afternoon nap and not have to worry that during that hour and a half that Aaron Judge is going to sign with my team. And, you know, you can't do that. Like we've seen players sign it like late at night. Remember when Gerrit Cole signed and everyone was like finishing dessert? And, So I it's two different worlds. And I also just think that makes it just like if the Guardians are ever going to win a World Series, and again, it's been 78 years, like it feels like they need to get past the Yankees in the playoffs for it to feel correct, if that makes sense.
Sure. Yeah, I think so. And obviously, you know, there's other versions of this in the National League and even in the American League, right? I mean, the dynamic, this kind of thing being played out to an extreme with the Brewers and the Dodgers last year is really what made me think about this. I mean, that was about as lopsided as you're going to see. And that's a team, the Brewers, that won more games in the regular season. And, you know, you felt like, okay, this is their chance. And they also met up in the postseason several times and lost in heartbreaking fashion. And I mean, I just think about, you mentioned some of the older ones, but just going back to 2 years ago, I mean, that series was so memorable, and that you go back and realize that Cleveland only won one game. Now, that was a game that we will all remember forever. It's one of the great postseason games of the last however long. We will certainly never forget everything that happened in that game. And yet it was just kind of a fun footnote in what was otherwise the Yankees doing what the Yankees do. And so I do think bringing this back to the current Guardians team, you sort of touched on it there, reviewing, like, this is where having a number one overall pick like Travis Bezzana, having a first round pick with real physical talent like Chase DeLauder, and you know, these guys are so far from reaching their peaks. And so counting on them to lead them past the Yankees as rookies is absurd. At the same time, those are the kinds of players that just make your team feel more threatening when it does get to October. And pitching's a big part of that too. And that's another reason why the Yankees this year just project to be so terrifying. I mean, you're going to see Gerrit Cole tonight against someone like Gavin Williams, who on his best day can resemble Gerrit Cole, but that's every five or six starts that the command is there and the swing and miss stuff is there. And Gerrit Cole is Gerrit Cole most of the time. You see what Cam Schlittler's become. You see them have the ability to go out and sign a Carlos Rodon to be who is now going to probably be like their five starter, let alone a Max Fried, and what they've been able to do with Will Warren and so on. So that's what makes the Yankees dangerous this year. It is on both sides of the ball, not to mention Judge. And you've got these enormous contracts like Stanton who aren't even playing, and you can just kind of plug in for the postseason and not even worry about what he's doing in the regular season. Those are the kinds of luxuries that are impossible to fathom when you're the small market team. And that's the margin for error that I think is frustrating. And honestly, from the front office perspective, because from the fan side, yeah, it is as simple as I wish my team could keep this player. And Cleveland's unique because Jose Ramirez is going to be there forever. But most chances, I want my team to be able to keep my star homegrown player. I want my team to be able to sign even mid-level free agents, let alone the Aaron Judges of the world. But it's just all the depth of the roster, the depth of the guys making $10 million, $15 million. It's just a completely different game. And that is obviously what sparks a lot of the conversations we're going to have around the CBA, for better or for worse, for fair or not, because ultimately, I am constantly now being in a small market and hearing the fans' perspective and hearing smart people like you's perspective, where you can imagine, yes, there's part of it that's like, this doesn't feel fair, and yet you don't want to go out there trying to speak and try to save money for the owners, because that's not, it's not like your point. But you have to understand the fans' perspective in that regard, too.
Yeah, I mean, maybe a perfect example of this is I flew to New York Tuesday morning. Pretty small Delta flight, two seats on each side. First class, I guess. I don't know if there were perks from that, but I sat in 11B. Not much leg room, but I like the aisle. And sitting in 12B right behind me was the owner of the Guardians, Paul Nolan. So, I don't know if there are Yankees fans who have been on a similar flight that holds like 48 people who have had a Steinbrenner sitting behind them. Credit to Paul. He didn't kick my seat.
Thank you. It's nice.
You know, it is a different world. And that's not to excuse anything. I mean, he could have splurged the $73 or whatever to sit in first class. But it's the Guardians have a tiny payroll. And I think one of the toughest things for a team like this is aligning everything, getting everything timed up properly. So you have the best possible roster you can. Like, you're right. You said it. If this is going to be the year that the Guardians make a run, you probably wish Bazzana and DeLauder were a little further along in their careers and just more experienced and had more just trial and error to lean upon. But like, you can wish cast it all you want. Like, you're never going to have that perfect roster because they just don't keep players for that long. Right. Like, once they get close to free agency and they're, you know, in that second year of arbitration, the trade talks start. Now, a lot of this could change, and I think that's what, you know, maybe is the focal point or a focal point of the CBA negotiations is how do you make it so that's not the case. But, you know, this guy's sitting behind me and I'm sitting there wondering, you know, how would you meet $170 million salary floor? You're not going to splurge on first class on this flight. So, it's wild.
Hey, Fabby, forget first class. I mean, let's be honest. Paul Dolan could afford to fly a private jet if he wanted to. We know that. Like, this is true for all these owners. Could he afford to have a $400 million payroll? I doubt that. But, you know, as we know, there are a lot of these owners that are pocketing revenue sharing and taking money that we just don't know because they don't open their books. But it is a good kind of illuminating anecdote where it's like they're just operating in a different level. And that's just how it works. That's just what they've used to. That's what's worked for them. And in the cases from teams like Cleveland and Milwaukee and Tampa Bay, what are you going to tell them? They're doing it wrong? Because I know they haven't won a World Series, but they're winning a lot of baseball games and they're feeling like they're putting a competitive product on the field. So it is an interesting dynamic, but one that I'm constantly trying to balance when I talk about it. And I'm always curious to hear from small market fans who, how do they balance those feelings of recognizing, not trying to necessarily speak on behalf of the owners and be like, oh, these poor guys, but also, yeah, you're looking at the landscape and saying, this isn't really fair. We don't really have a chance to have the best players in the world as consistently. And maybe that is the difference in October. Speaking of one of those players, we have an update on Mr. Aaron Judge, and this is kind of a big deal. Zach, you covered the first game of the series last night, and Aaron Judge, who's he's really good. You were asking me if I'm aware, know about Rhys Hoskins. Well, if you like home runs, let me just get a load of this guy, all right? This Aaron Judge fellow has been hitting a few of them over the years. He's hurt at least a little bit. He's dealing with a shoulder injury that's also something of a like a rib bruise, bone bruise situation. This is significant because he is not missing a game all season. He was in the starting lineup every game until Tuesday. His numbers did seem to take a serious dip over the last 10 to 15 games. Maybe that's a coincidence. Maybe he was fighting through something. This is a day-to-day situation. We don't know if he's going to go on the IL as we're recording this on Wednesday morning. As you probably still looked at the Yankees lineup last night, you were still like, well, this is still a pretty good lineup. We're not crying for the New York Yankees. But I do think that Aaron Judge missing any amount of time is kind of a big deal, partially because the Yankees do still, the whole lineup still functions when he is there, just looming as this terrifying presence. And also because Aaron Judge is trying to defend his MVP crown that he has successfully done for a while. And while Shohei Ohtani is doing his part in the National League, this has been a very strange AL MVP season so far. We talk about Jose Ramirez. He's usually in the conversation. His numbers are not necessarily up there right now. I mean, he's up there in war because of the defense and the base running, but offensively nowhere close. And even Aaron Judge, before his injury, was, I think, seventh in WRC Plus in the American League, 10th in war. Bobby Witt Jr. is way ahead of everybody else, but the Royals can't stop losing. So, first of all, what are your just broad Aaron Judge thoughts as someone who's covered games against him over the years? And then, yeah, what do you make of the state of the AL MVP race?
Well, I learned that your rib cage is connected to your shoulder. Did you know that?
Yeah. I guess. Yeah. Hopefully this isn't two completely separate injuries.
Yeah. I mean, the lineup definitely looks drastically different without him. And the lineup, their lineup is top heavy, even with him in there. Still, it's not, you know, there aren't automatic outs. I don't think a pitcher can take a deep breath facing that team, but like they need him in there for sure. Who wouldn't? But it's almost as if Jose Ramirez learned Aaron Judge has an injury and he's like, oh, that's right. I've been pursuing an MVP award for years and years and this guy's always standing in my way. Okay, fine. I'll turn it on now. And he has his three doubles. It's watching him hit in that ballpark is one of the joys of the sport. In part because he could hit a pop-up to like shallow center field and fans will ooh and ah the moment he makes contact because they think it's got a chance. So, you know, you don't want to see guys injured. You want to see players put up just crazy numbers when they can. And so, you know, hopefully it's not something too serious.
Yeah. And I mean, the point I've always made about Judge, and part of it is because he is gigantic, but he, and yes, short porch, he just hits home runs where you think, yeah, the field's too small for him. Like it feels like the big little leaguer. And you're like, oh no, he's on the wrong field. And there's not that like many guys that feel that way.
Yeah. He's like, if you have like an action figure and you can build like little ballparks out of Legos, but the action figure that's not made of Legos and you just stick it in there and he's enormous. Yeah, it's like, no, you're supposed to be playing a different world or galaxy where the ballparks are enormous.
Yeah, it's just the combination of the size, the ease of the swing. Obviously other guys have huge power, but it is a unique watch. And him, and as we're talking about his down year, whatever that means, is, you know, 150 WRC plus. So one of the best to ever do it. And we hope that he is not out for long. All right. We're going to take a break. When we return, I will welcome in a special guest. It's Cassandra Negley of Yahoo Sports to preview the Women's College World Series Championship Series. After that, Zach will return. And we're going to talk about the trade deadline, which is 2 months away. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Baseball Barbacast. I am so excited for our next segment. This is something that honestly, there are often times where I'm like, I just wish I could have a whole podcast about softball, but I will settle for one segment previewing the Women's College World Series Championship Finals. And here to do it with me is Cassandra Negley of Yahoo Sports. Cassandra, welcome to Baseball Barbercast.
Thanks for having me.
Cass, you are joining us from Oklahoma City, the site of the Women's College World Series, where I understand you are covering this event for the very first time. I am quite jealous. This is an event that is honestly above any baseball events on my personal professional bucket list. So I do hope that I get there at some point. But for now, you are there covering it for Yahoo Sports. You normally are covering women's basketball. But before we get into the specifics of the Texas Tech rematch, what's this week been like covering this event?
Well, I think same as you, like this has been a bucket list event for me. I've always dreamed of going. So to be here, I just feel so fortunate. I've had so many people tell me it's so special, and it is. The softball that has been played, like I'm going to be very transparent. I have lost track of everything that happened. Like days run into each other. There's been crazy comebacks and a whole bunch of game winners and extra innings. It is hard to keep track, but the softball is unbelievable. It's incredible to be here and see the food trucks and the fans and just the environment that Oklahoma has created for this event. Just truly a special experience.
Yeah, and every year I just urge people, especially once the tournament starts, get this on your TV because it comes across. And again, this is someone speaking who has never been there, and I think you're painting a good picture of what it's like in person. But as someone who, of course, you know, life has revolved around baseball and promoting that sport, I just think softball offers through TV so much of what baseball tries to get to, which is just fast-paced action. You're never bored. It's a shorter game. You know what you're getting. And the stakes of the Women's College World Series and understanding the careers that kind of culminate in Oklahoma City for these college athletes is what makes this event so special. And the star power that the sport has really produced over the last decade or so is undeniable. Now, let's set the stage for this Women's College World Series Finals, because I will say at the start of this event, we were first to talking about who wasn't there, right? Oklahoma and Florida. It was the first time since 07 that neither of those schools were in it. Oklahoma famously four-peating until Texas won last year. Florida, another powerhouse that didn't quite make it because Texas Tech defeated them in the Supers. I was so curious coming into this event, and I'm curious too what you've seen over the last week. Who would dominate the headlines? Who would kind of make this their tournament? Because Oklahoma's just been so omnipresent during these tournaments over the last, you know, handful of years. I was curious which stars would kind of ascend to that level. And there are several options. I'm curious who people have been buzzing about, not just Texas and Texas Tech, who have kind of been the storyline so far at the tournament.
Yeah, I had heard all of the noise that you probably heard that like attendance was going to be a little iffy, like what happens when Oklahoma isn't here because they're right down the road. That has not been the experience at all. There's been multiple record-breaking days. Like the fans are packing the house. Everyone has incredible, you know, attendance here. Nebraska seems to be the team that really just took off. Obviously have Jordy Ball from pitching for them, who just finished her career. But that pack of fans just was all over the place. In terms of stars, like we're going to talk Najee Kennedy, of course. Caitlin Terry has moved up there. UCLA's batters are huge names, but it really felt like Nebraska's World Series in terms of walking around Fan Fest and like they sold out the t-shirts in the tent. It was like Cornhuskers all the way.
Yeah. Yeah, and Nebraska, this is just making me think of this, that is a fan base that travels anywhere. I saw them play their baseball team, who unfortunately just got eliminated in their home regional this past weekend. I saw them opening weekend in Arizona. They opened their season down. I was down there covering spring training, and it was just, I mean, just an unbelievable amount of Nebraska fans for February regular season college baseball. So that is a passionate fan base. And of course, Jordy Ball, one of the biggest stories, the end of her career, announcing last night that she's pregnant, which is a whole other incredible storyline that we are going to put to the side for now because we're going to focus on the finals. But yeah, I mean, Nebraska is an amazing story for a lot of reasons, but they did not make it. This field did turn out to be loaded. It was hard. That was part of the fun too, is it was kind of hard to know who was going to get to this finals because You had Alabama, the number one overall seed, who had been so consistent all year. You had UCLA, who just had this unbelievable collection of offensive power. But then you had Texas and Texas Tech, who both lost early on in the field. And you thought, okay, well, maybe it's not going to happen. They battle their way back through the loser's bracket. On Monday, both of them win two games, Texas over Tennessee, Texas Tech over Alabama, to set up this, my understanding, is the first ever rematch in the Women's College World Series finals, which is kind of hard to imagine when you think about how many schools have like dominated, the fact that Oklahoma hasn't faced the same team in consecutive years, or however you want to think about that. So there's a ton of big storylines coming into this rematch, but what's maybe the first thing that you're thinking about before we start talking about some of the biggest names on these teams?
It is the first rematch since the finals became a series in 2005, I think. Okay. But there were some rematches prior, like some stretches, which included UCLA. The big thing coming into this one, I think, is just that it's a rematch. Like Jerry Glasgow was talking earlier today about Jerry and Mike White, I think, had spoken about there's parity in the game. Like we came into Oklahoma City not sure what was going to happen. And I think we saw there were so many big moments and the momentum went back and forth. And what each of these coaches and teams are talking about right now is just resilience. Like they kind of have last year's experience in their back pockets. They know what it takes to get through this kind of field when I think some other teams like Alabama maybe didn't. They have stars who are peaking at the right time. That's what Nigeri Kennedy had spoken about. And Nigeri Kennedy, man, coming off of that second game win, she actually looked like the Nigeri Kennedy that we saw last year. And I think that is huge for Texas Tech. You had mentioned Tegan Kavan when we spoke the other day. Same for her. Looks incredibly solid. It feels like these are just two teams who knew how to handle the season to get to this point because they just did it a year ago.
Oh, 100%. And yeah, I mean, I think we have to dig in to Nigeri Kennedy specifically, and we'll do that in a second. But I do also just want to kind of set the stage in terms of the context of this rematch. So last year, Texas won. That was their second. This is their third straight finals appearance. But last year was the first time they'd ever won at all, which might be hard to believe for a program. You would just assume that a school like Texas would have a championship in every sport by now. But last year was a big deal for them to finally get over the hump and win. Texas won in three games last year. The first game was Kavan versus Kennedy. That was a really close game that Texas won 2-1. The second game, Kavan did not start that game. Again, this is Texas's ace, Tegan Kavan. Kennedy narrowly survived a furious comeback in the seventh from Texas in game two. Tech won that game 4-3. And then in game three, Kennedy finally essentially ran out of gas. She allows five runs in the first inning, and Texas kind of cruises to that game three victory and the national title. But now we have a situation. I remember last year when Texas Tech lost, and it was like, oh my God, Kennedy got so close. And that, now let's just focus on Texas Tech here and kind of set up their story, right? This is for better or for worse, a real modern college athletics story. This is a school that I understand beyond just softball has embraced NIL and the portal to a degree that is borderline comical. But honestly, like, it's working. I mean, there's a lot of schools that are doing this crazy to a crazy degree, and they're still losing. Texas Tech has become a powerhouse in multiple sports. Weirdly, their baseball team keeps getting worse and worse. But softball has become a true powerhouse. And Nigeri Kennedy arriving on this historic $1 million NIL deal last year. She spent her first 2 years of school at Stanford, where she was in the College World Series. And so this is her fourth straight year in Oklahoma City. She's this unbelievable two-way player, but mostly known for her pitching. So Kennedy shows up last year and just changes the program. Jerry Glasgow, their head coach, had arrived from Louisiana Lafayette. He had brought some of their best players, and they also were part of this. But when they lose last year to Texas, it was like, man, like, it's not going to get any easier, you know, but you also knew what's Texas Tech going to do? They're going to load up and try again. And if you look at their lineup, so Kennedy's back for her senior year. If you look at their lineup, their top five hitters, I believe, are all new players who they got from the portal from five different schools. That is Mia Williams at second base from Florida. Mm-hmm. That is Caitlin Terry from UCLA, who we will talk about. Taylor Pannell from Tennessee. Jackie Liz from Southern Illinois. Jazzy Burns from Ohio State. And their catcher, of course, Loggie Quiroga from Cal. I I'm sure that this has made some people watching Texas Tech roll their eyes and be like, this is ridiculous that this is an all-star team. But Jerry Glasgow is, I think, a treat to just like watch and listen to. I'm curious your experience with him. How would you describe being around this team? What is the vibe of this mishmash of transfer all-stars around Najee Kennedy and co?
They fully know what is being said about them and just kind of like the situation that they're in. Jerry Glasgow is quickly becoming one of my favorite coaches to cover in college athletics because this man just like does not care. It was not but 2 hours ago. He brings it up again. He's like, everyone's talking about us as the villains. And he has this quote where he's like, I think I'm Cinderella. Like, little girls love me. Like, it's fine. And it's just so funny the way he goes about. Like, he's so honest and transparent. And he's just like, yeah, let me be the villain. I don't care. I think Najee Kennedy early on in the series also had a really good quote about this where she said, like, this is what you want. If we want to grow women's sports specifically, there's going to be villains and heroes and money and, you know, buying talent because that's just what it is. And you can disagree with that as, you know, a fan, but there is an argument to be made that like Texas Tech is just using the assets available to them to get a roster that they hope is going to win them a championship. It is what it is.
Yeah, and it's a great point, and they still deserve credit, and I think this is where Glasgow does deserve credit because they're not the only school or sports program that is trying to just smash a bunch of talent together pulled from all these different schools and hope that it works. I can think of plenty of examples in college baseball, but I think even in college softball where this hasn't necessarily worked to the same degree, and yet here Texas Tech is again. I think that is what speaks to Glasgow, who's, I agree, like personality-wise, is so fascinating to listen to. There's so many things about his background and his come up that is really interesting. Some like real tragedy in his family that is also very compelling. But he's amazing. I'm all in on Jerry Glasgow. But Kennedy is, I mean, Kennedy is the story. And as important as this offense that they've put together is, Kennedy is still, she's the whole thing. Now, I will say, last year, she really was the whole thing in terms of what they had in the circle and who was pitching. What is really interesting this season, and particularly what we've seen in this World Series, and I know you wrote about this, and this is the most important storyline I think people have to understand about Texas Tech as we go into this final series, is Caitlin Terry, who they got from UCLA, who is also a hitter and one of their best hitters as well. But in softball, for those unfamiliar, you are allowed to re-enter as a pitcher. Now, there's some rules involving the lineup configurations and all that. I won't bore people with that. And frankly, I don't even totally understand it. So let's just move on. Like, I get confused with some of those specifics anyway. But the basic fact is that pitchers can re-enter. They can start a game and then they can either go to the field or get moved to different parts of the lineup and they can come back in. In the past, we have seen certain situations where a starter will pitch and then maybe they'll come back in at the end of a game if the situation gets bad. So that it's not unheard of. However, what we've seen from Texas Tech with Caitlin Terry's emergence and obviously Kennedy's somewhat struggles until this last game where it just looked like, oh my God, she's the best pitcher in the world, is them legitimately going back and forth at almost on a whim. I know you've kind of written about how you would describe it, which I'll let you do that. They are literally alternating every 2.5 innings. And there was a stretch less yesterday or a couple of days ago where it was like, okay, one would allow a homer and then, okay, back to the other one. And then the other, she would allow a homer and then back to the other one. Kennedy got in a groove and kind of finished it off yesterday. But just describe that dynamic and how they seem to be pretty bought in on it.
They seem to be okay with it, which I think is really interesting. And whenever they're asked about it, they're just like, oh, we stay ready. Like, that's our job. There has to be more to it than that, but we'll let that go to the side for now. Jerry said the other night when he swapped them, I don't even know how many times, like us in the press box are just trying to like help each other count. But he said he just kind of does it on a hunch. Like, things happened in doubles in their super regional with Florida. And I think he's just very concerned that it'll happen again. And so he's haunted by that. And he's just like, seems like, especially knowing Jerry a little bit, and you mentioned his personality, he's just like, oh, you know what? Like, maybe Caitlin would be good right now. And then you put her in and she goes like two batters. And you're like, oh, she gave up single. You know what? I want Najee back in there. She'll do great. And he just, but it's working. It's working. And then to get Nigeri last night to the point where they're all talking about her peaking and she has her best stuff and she's baffling batters, like, you wonder what the World Series is going to look like. Is he going to go back to just swapping these pitchers like on a whim?
That's a great question. And based on how good Kennedy looked, I have to imagine plan A is to just let her roll until she shows any amount of shakiness. But the fact that they have that as an option is really compelling and also an interesting contrast to some of the other teams in the tournament. For example, UCLA, who rode Taylor Tinsley to the bitter end, their senior who, I mean, salute, God bless, what a heroic effort from her, the senior who threw 180 plus pitches in her final outing.
Yeah.
And that was a situation where, you know, they just didn't have any other pitchers that they could trust. And these softball pitchers, they can go, like, they can handle it. Mm-hmm. But that was to the extreme. And I think it ultimately was, you know, not fair to Taylor Tinsley. And as cool as it was, and like, I think everyone admires her, whatever. You also have situations like Tennessee, who had three incredible pitchers but couldn't quite find the perfect combination. They ultimately bow out. This is a good transition over to Texas. So Texas Tech, I mean, it's an all-star team. They have more talent, and their numbers are more eye-popping, and Kennedy is, you know, singular, and Terry's awesome. So, however, they did not win last year. That was Texas. And a big part of that is because of their ace, Tegan Kavan. Now, the Texas does have another very good pitcher in Citlali Gutierrez, who did pitch yesterday as well. However, you could tell, like, and honestly, Tennessee's probably kicking themselves because that was the opportunity, was to beat not Kavan, and they were unable to do that. Tegan Kavan is a junior. She was the most outstanding player in last year's College World Series. She had the shutout, or at least the complete game in the clincher last year. And she's just rock solid. I mean, this is just as, like, she is ready to go. And so I would expect her to essentially pitch the entirety of this series. We will see. I don't know if Mike White, their head coach, gave any sort of hint towards that. But let's just talk about Kavan a little bit and what you've seen from her.
Yeah, Kavan has been lights out. Mike didn't really go either way about what he's doing. And I think handling your pitchers in terms of softball is very different than baseball. And it's very intriguing. You mentioned that Tennessee-Texas matchup. And Tennessee's head coach, Karen Weekly, had talked about you have to plan as if there's a second game. But also it feels like, don't you want to, like, really try and win the first if you're in that position to win the first in advance?
Yep.
Obviously a little different when you're playing like a game every night. But Mike did talk about Citlali and that she's really come along. They have confidence in her. You heard from a lot of coaches this week that this stage is different. And so to get a pitcher out there and give her some time to settle in, maybe that does help them out in the series. But I would expect it to be the same as last year, where Kavan is really going to step in for them, try and shut it down, and be the winning pitcher. I think what we've seen throughout the series is that, and this is so dumb and obvious, but you need a little bit of both. Like, you need some offense and you need some good pitching. And the teams that were too far on one side are out of the tournament.
Yeah. No, that's very well said. And I think the thing about Kavan that is so compelling for me is she's only a junior, and her what she did last year as a sophomore, what I should also mention, Katie Stewart, Texas's best hitter, who I think is up to 30 home runs now, and she's just an absolute force. There's more familiarity in this lineup compared to Texas Tech in terms of holdovers and, you know, players that were in the lineup last year. Their catcher, Reese Atwood, is also terrific. But Tegan Kavan here has a real opportunity to start to, you know, enter into some pretty special conversations in terms of the best pitchers we've seen in college softball. And it's kind of gone under the radar, but it's just an incredible chance for her to do this. An incredible challenge, of course, but man, if she can beat Texas Tech again, that's just incredible, especially knowing she can come back next year and build on it as a senior. I mean, this season, really over those last few years, we've just seen so many legends of this era of college softball move on. And we know we're watching the end with Nyjah Kennedy. We know, you know, Jordy Ball, her senior season, a lot of those UCLA superstars are now moving on. And a lot of players in this, you know, even this finals are going to be seniors. We're not going to see them anymore. But for Kevon and Stewart, both on Texas' side, just thinking about what they've already built and what they can continue to build as as homegrown Longhorns, I mean, they have a couple transfers on their team, but their roster is a lot more of a group that, that Mike White recruited and has clearly mm-hmm. built them into a pretty compelling, you know, mm-hmm. championship contender. So, I mean, there's just I'm so excited. I think that it felt like we were heading towards Tennessee would have been a cool story because they've never won before. Alabama's only won once. It's been a while. You know, Alabama, Texas would have been a cool heavyweight if it was Tennessee. Alabama, you know, SEC, but I think this rematch is so compelling for the casual fan, and I'm just so excited. So, with all that said, I mean, I'll put you on the spot. Who you got? Who you're rolling with here? I haven't decided, and I'm going to force myself to decide in the next 10 seconds. But I'll make you pick.
Okay.
First.
Okay.
Who you got?
You know, I came into the day really thinking like Texas. I had gone back. Obviously, it used to be a single game championship. But if you look back, there aren't a lot of teams that got the rematch and won the next year. So I just kind of feel like Texas has the edge, knows what it takes. But then I was listening to Texas Tech and their press conference today, and I kind of wonder if it's just like that hunger that comes in. Like, they also were here. They know what it takes to lose. And so now you really know what to put in to win. They've gone out, gotten all of these players. Like, I don't think you can overlook the fact that they've brought in, as you have detailed many times, like some of the very best talent in the game. They all basically get a revenge tour through their former teams, which has created a headline every single night. Like, sometimes I'm not saying this, but I think sometimes it's just like, the bad guys always win.
Yeah. And that's the thing. And I think labeling Texas Tech as the bad guys is a stretch, and I don't think that's fair to them.
I would agree.
And listen, I don't know how many casuals are going to be like going out of their way to root for Texas. Like, it's Texas. I mean, come on. Like, it's not like the Longhorns are, especially as the defending champs. So maybe there's some people that are like, oh, I don't want to see either of these teams win. I think Texas Tech is going to do it. I think that their talent is so overwhelming at this point, and just the way that they're playing, the resilience that they've shown, it just feels like that is the correct ending here. And yet, I mean, this is why I just keep coming back to Kevon. If she can pull this off, man, against this offense, that's the other difference. I mean, that, you know, the Texas Tech was a good team last year with a good offense. This is a totally different beast that she's going to have to deal with. And I do wonder if she has any sort of shakeup. Does Gutierrez, do they have enough to kind of keep up, frankly, with the Texas Tech offense? I think that's something that we kind of saw Alabama was struggling with by the end. Obviously, Kennedy's pitching has a lot to do with that. But however it goes, as we'll just finish on the obvious that we keep coming back. I mean, this is a Nyjah Kennedy. Like, this is an incredible ending to a one of the most important careers in women's college athletics history. And so I don't want to overlook that. And I think that that is still the headline, whether she wins or loses. And frankly, the other thing I keep coming back to is, it's like, guess what Texas Tech is going to do as soon as the season is over? They're going right back in the portal, and, you know, the Terry will be back and whatever. But I mean, they're going to do it again, and whether or not they're going to do that until they win it all, and maybe that is this year. And it's by the way, if they do win, they're going to do that anyway, right? So it's like, it's not going to slow them down. But hey, as you know, that's college athletics in 2026, for better or for worse.
It is. I do have kind of a heartwarming thing to say about the whole Texas Tech transfer situation. You know, Jerry was asked about this today. Like, how do you get the best out of players that you literally just brought in? Because this really does feel like a championship series of, are you loyal or are you, you know, willing to jump around? And he really went long, because it's Jerry, on every player needs something different. And we saw that in the dugout the other night with him and Nyjah. And Nyjah comes out and throws that complete game. And he talked about, you know, maybe a player like Mia Williams needs or doesn't trust as much at first. And so you have to be patient. And to the point you made earlier, like, he's very thoughtful. And I think especially based on his life history, about finding the right ways to get the best out of these players that he's brought in. It's not just asking a great player to come in and win a championship for him. It's pulling the best out of them. And maybe that's why after listening to that, I really feel like it could be Texas Tech's to win. Just hearing everything that goes into it. It's not just, hey, we're going to pay $1 million for a star pitcher and she's going to throw her best stuff and we're going to win. Like, there's a lot more to it than that.
Yeah. But it helps.
Not wrong, Jordan.
No. That was a great note to end on. Sorry, I'm obnoxious for ruining that sentiment. Because I frankly I'm totally torn on it too. I go back and forth thinking like this is the coolest thing ever, and I love Jerry Glasgow, and also same, rolling my eyes at the whole experience. But I think that's a pretty modern reality of a lot of our sports watching nowadays. Cassandra, this was a treat. Thank you so much. I encourage everyone to go read her coverage over these next few days and all the stories she's put out so far. It's been great work for someone covering it for the first time, for sure. So thank you for doing this. And I look forward to much more softball conversations off the air. But thanks for joining us on Baseball Barbercast.
Thanks, of course. Let's always talk softball.
Welcome back to Baseball Barbercast. Thanks again to Cassandra Negley for previewing Texas Tech. Oh my goodness, I'm so excited to watch those games. But let's get back to baseball. Zach Meisel, you are back on the show after that lengthy break. And we have to talk about the trade deadline, which is 2 months away. Let's go around the league. Zach, we're going to keep this pretty broad here, but because the trade deadline is exactly 2 months from today, yes, this year the deadline is on August 3rd, for those wondering. The league, as part of the most recent CBA, essentially decided we can make the deadline whenever we want between this range of like 7 or 8 days, and they decided that this year it'll be on August 3rd, which I believe is a Monday, and also, I guess, more time for teams to wait until the very, very last second to make decisions about who they will be trading, or as we've seen in the Guardians case in recent seasons, who they will not be trading. Now, last year, the Cleveland Guardians around deadline time were in hell. I mean, let's just be honest. Things were very bad. I guess the bottom was a little bit before. No, that was pretty much the buy. There were a lot of low points in the middle of last summer, but that was a pretty bad time, I would say.
3 days before the trade deadline, their closer was swept up in the gambling investigation. So could have been better timing.
Yeah, it was not great. Now, as we know, they then rallied. The Tigers collapsed. They win the division anyway. But this year, as we stare at the situation, by all accounts, the Guardians should be a team in buying position. I don't want to just talk about Cleveland here, but I do just want to use these next 5 to 10 minutes as an opportunity to look at these messy standings and try and think. 2 months is a long time, but at some point, these teams are going to have to make some decisions here and decide whether they're buyers or sellers. We know we have this extra postseason spot, which is incentivized teams. No, let's just stay in it. Let's give it a shot. Maybe we get in. We make some magic happen. Playoff odds are going to determine these teams' directions. This is what we keep referring to with the Tigers and the Tarek Skubal decision. We can look at playoff odds on Fangraphs or Baseball Prospectus or whatever, and we can say, oh my God, they only have X chance to make it. Teams have their own internal models that are telling them, hey, you know, you got a 5% chance to make postseason. Like, sorry, we got to trade these veterans. Let's talk about Cleveland quickly, specifically before we open it up. I think what makes them so interesting this year is just the state of their roster, the amount of surplus, particularly on the position player side, players that have reached the upper minors, have succeeded, but don't have spots in the major leagues, in addition to some interesting prospects beyond that. And yet, Cleveland is not a team that is usually out there trying to make big swings and dealing away prospects. Is this the year that finally changes and they're willing to deal away some of this AAA depth, maybe some top 100 prospects, to make a real push to maybe run away with the division and actually challenge for something serious?
They're set up perfectly. Like, they are positioned
they really
exactly
are.
Where you'd want to be if you're any team, not even just a small market team, because they play in a very lousy division. If they can fend off those plucky upstart White Sox, they're in pretty good shape. And I think they have a more well-rounded roster than they've had in recent years, even in division-winning years. And they have a really good farm system, even with Chase DeLauder and Travis Pezzana graduating to the major leagues. Like, they've got Angel Hanau as a top 100 prospect. He's a shortstop, but he's blocked by Brian Rocchio and Travis Pezzana, or Ralphie Velasquez, who they love. And I don't know that they would trade him, but he's a first baseman, and they have a lot of people who can play first base. So Cooper Engle, another top 100 guy who's a catcher, but they just traded for Patrick Bailey. So they're now trying out Cooper Engle in the outfield. They have the surplus, as you mentioned, if they want to. And in recent years, they haven't been as aggressive. A couple years ago, they settled for Lane Thomas and Alex Cobb at the deadline. Mixed results there. But if you rewind a little more, this organization does have a history of being aggressive at certain selective points. 2011, they were like a pseudo contender, kind of on the cusp. They actually thought they'd be better the following year and the year after that. And they went and traded for Ubaldo Jimenez, who was like the top pitcher available. And they traded their previous two first round picks to get him. So that was atypical of them. 2016, famously, they trade for Andrew Miller. That changes the complexion of that entire season, and they almost win a World Series because of it. They tried to trade for Jonathan Lucroy that deadline as well. That would have been four more prospects they were parting with, and Lucroy vetoed the trade. 2018, they flirted with the Bryce Harper sweepstakes, and they never truly believed Harper was going to be available. Ended up, ownership nixed it and said, we're not trading him. But they wanted the Nationals to know that, like, hey, if you're going to do this, like, call us, please. So instead, a month later, they went and they got Josh Donaldson at the waiver deadline. So, like, it's in the DNA somewhere, like, that if the timing is right, they can be aggressive and make that move that has everybody else in the league saying, wait, that guy's going to Cleveland? I think that they haven't maybe believed in themselves or felt comfortable enough with the farm system health to do this in recent years. And I feel like there's no excuse this time, right? Like, the payroll's super low.
Really,
so if you have to add some salary, I think that should be okay. And if you have to part with some prospects, your roster is so young that I think you'll have time to replenish that farm system. And you have to believe in your scouting and drafting and developing abilities enough anyway. So, they are in prime position here to make some noise.
Yeah, they really are. And to the point where, I mean, let's see where we're at. A lot of baseball to be played, how far ahead, or if they're still fending off the White Sox, if one of these other teams makes a push. But I hope we see them do something serious, because it's not just that they can afford to in all these respects. It's that in some reasons, you kind of got to clear out this mess of a surplus, because you're just making it. I know depth is nice to have, and I'm sure they believe that more than anybody, but it's kind of absurd the amount of players they have in AAA now who were either already in the big leagues, like a CJ Kapus, or someone who's trying to break through, like Engle or Watson or Velasquez. Let's keep the focus on the American League, which has certainly been the league that has disappointed us the most so far. I think you can safely say Seattle playing great. They just won their eighth in a row last night. That's a team we've seen be active at the deadline. I expect that again. Another team that has a top-heavy farm system but has the pieces to make a move. We know DePoto's going to be trying to do that. Yankees, same thing. Their farm system, not as good, but we know they're going to go. I expect them to certainly make a bullpen move, maybe patch up something else if they have some other injuries. I think Toronto, a team we talked extensively about on Monday, almost no matter where they're at, they're going to try to add, because I just think that as weird as the season has been, all the injuries, they're below 500. They've lost three in a row. That organization is just not in a position to go backwards, I think, for any reason, frankly. So I think as long as they're floating in the middle and they don't lose the next 30 games in a row, I think they are going to be buyers. Other than that, who are the other AL teams you're watching that could kind of move in either direction dramatically that you would expect?
Yeah, I think we focus so much on buyers and sellers, but I think it's maybe more appropriate to think of it in terms of who's good, who thinks they're good, who thinks they could be good, and who's given up, right? Like that's the state of the American yeah. League. I have no idea what to make of the Texas Rangers.
Yeah.
And yep. they could have some interesting veteran pieces available if they go the other direction. They're playing better lately. You know, a team like the White Sox, like how do they assess where they're at? Do they feel like there is legitimacy to their winning record? And how aggressive do you want to be in the infancy of what you hope is a sustained run? I don't know the answer to that. And they might not know the answer because I don't know that they expected to be in this position. The Central itself. Like, are the Twins going to finish what they started last trade deadline?
Yes.
Or do they think because the Central is weak that they're in this?
I would be surprised if, now again, their playoff odds are still at 25%. And because of how terrible Detroit and Kansas City have been, and if we assume the White Sox are going to regress, then yeah, I guess you could factor them in. And if the rest of the AL doesn't get its, you know, stuff together, I guess they could make noise. I still think that they end up trading Joe Ryan, trading Ryan Jeffers if he gets healthy. And then I think the last team we just have to acknowledge here is Tampa, which is every year they're bizarre. And we've seen them do buying and selling at the same time when they've been good, buying and selling at the same time when they've been bad. I'm so excited to see what they do because with their farm system also pretty stacked, they could just go in so many different directions. There are holes on that roster that they could fill if they think they can actually compete to win the AL East, which they're still ahead of the Yankees right now. What does aggressive look like there? Because they've just shown all kinds of strange sequences. And by the way, I think Cleveland could fit into that bucket as well. Yeah. Oh, my God. And then
what about the Tigers?
Of course, the main character. Yeah, the Tigers are the ultimate main character here for all the wrong reasons. And we're going to have a million Scooble conversations when it gets to that point. And yeah, I know he said again yesterday after he threw his simulated, BP, like, hey, if we start winning, we won't be talking about this. That's fine. You're in such a hole that you can't. Ken Rosenthal just wrote a piece about this at The Athletic recently. Like, you literally can't afford anymore. Like bad weeks. You just can't. You're 16 games under is so far down that even if he comes back and is pitching well, that is going to be the biggest question that we're talking about. So, yeah, look good the last couple nights, though. Good for them.
Do you think the Tigers almost can't stand pat, right? If you're not going to trade Scooble, do you almost have to
shouldn't
add?
You buy? Yeah. Which is a good place to end this conversation here. Just as the broader thing that we will also be thinking about, and this could be its own long conversation, but I know it's something we talked about off the air, so I wanted to mention it. And especially for a team like Detroit, if you're trying to pull off the buy and sell, if you're trying to keep the bigger picture in mind, maybe you acknowledge that adding for this year is not going to result in a postseason appearance. Okay, well, then what do? Let's try and target players that will be under contract next season. Well, what is that worth? I am the last person that wants to caveat everything about next season by saying, well, what about what's going to happen? Are they going to play? How many games are they going to play? But the reality is our conversations with front offices are telling us that is something that they are keeping in mind. And so trying to evaluate a player that is under contract through 2027 is a very weird task right now. And so I that will be something that is also talked about a lot. And certainly for teams like the Tigers, I imagine they are going to have to think about this, because if you're like them, it's like, all right, maybe we're not going to make it this year, but if we can get someone that can help us in 27, fine, we'll trade some of these prospects for that. Maybe teams, especially in smaller markets, are less likely to do that.
Yeah, I had a conversation with an exec recently, and the way they framed it was, if you're going to trade for someone with more control just beyond 2026, there is an added level of uncertainty, just not knowing what next season or if there will be a next season looks like. And who should bear that risk? Is it the team trading the veteran player, or is it the team trading the prospects? Who gets to determine the price tag here, and who bears the risk? Is it the buyer or the seller? And
Yeah.
I think these teams are going to be arguing that right up until August 3rd.
Which, frankly, is unfortunate because the group of rental players who are free agents this year, besides Skubal, and who are not on good teams, is very short. And so I do think at some point the teams are just going to say, screw it. Like, yeah, we'll trade for the... And maybe they view it as you could seize on the advantage of it. You could say, oh, wait a minute. Yeah, we're going to play. I'm not worried about missing games. Great. I get a discount on this player because you are worried. You know, that dynamic could favor a team. Maybe they make emboldens a team to go after a player who maybe is more easily acquirable. So a lot of dynamics. 2 months is a long time, but I do think it is worth... This is when teams are starting to have these conversations. And so I think it is a reason why we can start having these conversations. Zach Meisel, this has been a delight. I hope you enjoyed your baseball Barbiecast debut. Long overdue, for sure. But you did a great job in Jake Mintz's absence. Any final thoughts before I wrap us up?
No, I wish Jake would take more vacations. This has been a pleasure.
Okay. I wish Jake would take more vacations. I don't. I've had fun hosting without him, but it'll be nice to have him back. Speaking of Jake, I will finish with a nod to the story that he wrote yesterday about our pal Sarah Langs in honor of Lou Gehrig Day. Just go read it. Obviously, Sarah's a very important person in our lives and a lot of people in the baseball industry's lives. Someone who has become, of course, unfortunately, one of the faces of ALS and a disease that is horrible and heartbreaking. But also, Sarah Langs is an unbelievable human who, as Jake so eloquently wrote, is still working and still giving us so much as baseball consumers, baseball analysts, and baseball fans. So go check out the story that Jake wrote about Sarah. And thank you, Zach, for co-hosting with me. Thank you to Cassandra Negley again for joining us to preview the Women's College World Series Finals, which I know a lot of people are watching Knicks Spurs tonight, but check out Texas Tech because it is going to be a blast. Thank you to Andrew Hartz and Ingrid Rosas for producing, as always. And we'll be back on Friday with Jake Mintz and the good, the bad, the ugly, and so much more. Until then, see you later.